Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, November 14th, 2009, and I'm Harley Schlanger. I will be your host today. This last Wednesday, Lyndon LaRouche presented another historic webcast in which he provided an absolutely clear picture of the present existential crisis and the two main options facing humanity. There are two options, he said. One is we can continue in the same direction of British-directed warfare against the United States and against the civilized world. And if that continues, mankind will be plunged into a new dark age for several generations to come. And the present course of the Obama administration, with its Nazi healthcare policy and with its continued bailout of the banks and destruction of the physical economy, is pushing us in that direction. On the other hand, we have a second option. If we can put the Obama administration under adult control and bring the U.S. into a four-power agreement with Russia, China, and India, then we can launch a new era of technological and scientific progress, which will allow humanity not only to bring in peace and prosperity to Earth, but to begin a new era of man colonization of our solar system through the unleashing of the creativity of the human race. There's a political force that's in its infancy in the United States to do this, a mass strike process, an anger against the destruction of this country. And the question is, will we be able to educate it and move it in a direction that will bring the second option into being quickly enough? Joining us today on the LaRouche Show to discuss this will be Jeffrey Steinberg, a senior editor from EIR and a longtime friend of the show. And Jeff, you're here. Welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Harley.
Now, before we bring on Jeff, we have an extremely exciting announcement to make. This will be a breaking news development that will probably be the talk of the country tomorrow, at least that I know the talk of Beantown. And this is a LaRouche Show exclusive on the line from Boston. We have LaRouche Youth Movement activist Rachel Brown. Rachel, are you with us?
Yes. Hi, Harley.
Hi, Rachel. So you have a breaking news announcement. What is it?
Okay. Well, I am happy to announce that I am a candidate for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Congress, Massachusetts District 4, against bailout Barney Frank.
Okay. Now, when I say exciting, this is really exciting because you were catapulted into the news in the period of the town meeting ferment last August, where you had a confrontation with Barney, and for people who saw the whole confrontation, he was left stammering. Why don't you give people a report from your perspective of what you did and how Barney responded at that time?
Okay. I think the main reason why Barney didn't want to answer the question was because I brought up the crucial issue that the White House was ignoring the collapse of the living standard for the population, and that he could talk about various figures constructed by the media and this invisible recovery that's occurring in whichever fashion he wanted to, but the population knows that they're being betrayed and dismissed by the White House. And yeah, that in addition to the clear policy similarity between Obama's healthcare policy and Hitler's healthcare policy in 1939, which put a dollar value on human life, and actually set up a private board of accountants that would decide which lives were worth living and which weren't.
Now, Rachel, at that town meeting, you weren't the only person in opposition to Barney Frank.
No, the whole crowd was against Barney.
And it wasn't just, as you're pointing out, it wasn't just about health care, but a whole range of issues on which bailout Barney has betrayed the American people. You mentioned the collapse of the economy. I think the listeners know that Barney Frank has been one of the front men for continuing the policy of Paulson and the Bush administration of bailing out the bankrupt banks and fighting against a Franklin Roosevelt-style solution, such as the LaRouche Plan. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about how you're going to take this on in the campaign?
Well, I guess I don't have to point out to people too much the problem that, that Barney represents. They're experiencing it, and they have a general sense of betrayal of the Congress as it is. I can make it more clear for them specifically how it has been through Barney Frank's leadership in the Financial Services Committee that policy after policy has been passed that are continuing the destruction of the economy. Whether it was Barney specifically shutting down LaRouche's HBPA, Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, where he said in committee that he thought that it was against the Constitution to freeze foreclosures. He said he thought there was constitutional problems with the idea of legislation to freeze foreclosures.
Yeah, he's for more free trade of shutting down housing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's for letting the banks just close down houses, kick people on the streets, and then try and build up a new bubble. But he actually said that it would be a constitutional problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Go ahead, what else?
You just went through the basics of it. People are against the bailout. They need to understand the solution that Barney has been ignoring, and specifically, refusing to allow the population to understand, which is LaRouche's solution. So generally, I think that's what I'm going to be campaigning on, is to give people a sense of the fundamentals of a physical economy, what we really need to get out of this.
And of course, as you know, the Boston area 20 years ago was a center of technology, and now the situation there, the state is heading into bankruptcy. Can you give us a picture on the ground of what's happening with the economy, and not just in Frank's district, but in the general area?
I can only say, just from my on-the-street organizing, that I'm generally experiencing probably greater than 30% unemployment rate, especially among college-educated, people in their 30s to 40s. A vastly increasing amount of those people that are saying things like, I know it's a dark age. Soon it's going to be a dark age for me. But, that's generally the way I've been experiencing it.
And we've seen mobilizations like the town meeting. I think there were a number of meetings where there were fairly large crowds, the Tea Party, the Ron Paul networks, unemployed people. So I think, Rachel, we can expect that you're going to get a real head of steam going in this campaign. Do you know when the primary is?
Possibly September.
All right, so there's plenty of time. Now, I'd like you to stay on the program because you may have some other things to add, and Jeff may have a question or a comment for you, but I'd like to make this point to our listeners that this is not just a campaign in Boston, because Barney Frank does represent, in a sense, and putting it this way may make people a little queasy, but he's sort of the poster boy for everything that's about the betrayal of the American people in the U.S. Congress. And so your candidate, the person who's standing up and speaking for you, is Rachel Brown. And so we're going to be calling on our supporters and our would-be supporters around the country to back up this campaign, because we're going to need a full national focus on this, because if we can knock out Barney Frank, and, my sense, Rachel, is that he's not that popular. I know he's got a certain kind of support base of basically your usual crazy ultra-liberals up in the Boston area, but have you detected a certain sense of what you've been reporting, the sense of anger at the betrayal? Is that growing?
Towards Barney specifically?
Yeah.
People
recognize him as one of the key people in the problem, right?
Yeah. Most people that are angry know the role of Barney Frank. I have yet to discover exactly what's happening in his districts, being as that his district was the original source of gerrymandering. I don't exactly know the characteristics of these towns that are specifically in his district, but I imagine that we're gonna be able to find people that are affected by the economy and can understand Barney's role in that.
Well, let me bring on Jeff just to continue this discussion on Barney Frank and Rachel's candidacy. I mean, Jeff, you can give us from the Washington side a picture of what Barney Frank has, what his presence on the House Financial Services Committee means.
Sure. Well, look, I think, first of all, as Rachel knows, and as some of us in the LaRouche PAC work in Washington know, we had a number of discussions with Barney Frank back a few years ago at the point that this financial blowout process first began to really surface. And what's clear is that he indicated in those discussions a certain understanding of just what kind of unsustainable financial bubble existed, particularly with respect to the hedge fund, these completely massive leveraged derivatives, completely unregulated. He knew that, and therefore, precisely because he has been the person as chairman of the House Financial Services Committee who has protected and defended those precise financial interests, you've got to operate under the assumption that this guy is completely bought and paid for by the very financial interests that are destroying the United States and bringing on a dark age. I mean, I know that right now, as chairman of that committee, Barney Frank is willfully sabotaging the introduction of a bill to audit an annual audit of the Federal Reserve. This is a bill that was introduced by Congressman Ron Paul, who is one of the ranking Republicans on Barney Frank's committee. And much to Ron Paul's own surprise, I suspect, that bill has about 300 or more co-sponsors.
And then Frank himself became a co-sponsor as a way of being a submarine from within, huh?
Right. Well, what he's done is he said, I support the bill, but I want to attach it to other legislation. Right now, by the rules of the House of Representatives, when you've got more than a majority of members co-sponsoring a bill, it should be brought directly to the floor of the House for debate and vote. It doesn't even have to go through a committee process. It can be placed immediately before the full House. Now, the Federal Reserve is petrified over the idea of any kind of regulation and any kind of honest and transparent audit, because the first thing it'll show is that the Fed is bankrupt, hopelessly bankrupt beyond repair. And the second thing it would show is that the Fed has committed probably the greatest act of conflict of interest in the history of our republic. Remember, the Federal Reserve, under the law that established it, is actually a private institution, and the shareholders in the Federal Reserve are the major New York City Wall Street financial institutions. And what the Fed has been systematically doing as part of its hyperinflationary policy, first under Greenspan and now on steroids under Bernanke, has been to give preferential treatment to a group of banks that were once called too big to fail and are now too big to fail.
Huh.
And so we've seen, as of last Friday, 122 regional and community banks around the United States have gone bankrupt since January 1st. And the Fed is continuing to pour trillions of dollars into bailing out these hopelessly bankrupt big banks, typified by J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, especially Goldman Sachs, which is now a bank holding company.
So, Jeff, we're seeing under these so-called deregulation policies, which are supposed to enhance competition, at least according to the fraudulent theory, we're seeing instead a consolidation.
Precisely. We're seeing a total consolidation. And, in fact, the most bankrupt banks are the ones that are surviving, whereas the regional and community-based banks, which are much more connected to the actual physical economies of those locales, are the ones that are being shut down, taken over by the FDIC. And
they're only surviving because of the protection racket that's being run by people like Barney Frank and up at least until recently, Senator Chris Dodd, his sidekick in crime, that they're the ones who are making sure that there's nothing done to get in the way of the bailout, which is why I think it will be very effective in this campaign that Rachel's opponent is not Representative Barney Frank, but bailout Barney Frank.
I think he's going to have a tremendously difficult time now that Rachel is announced and now that he's going to be directly challenged in the Democratic primaries. I think that this is going to cause him great, great consternation. And this, to my mind, is a winning proposition for Rachel to actually defeat Barney Frank and be the Democratic nominee comes November.
Well, we already know, Rachel, that the one opportunity Barney had to answer your question, he went into a total hysterical fit. So he's ducked you in the past. I assume you're going to be issuing a challenge for him to debate you as soon as we get the announcement out.
Yeah, that would be a lot of fun.
Well, and what I think this question of Barney, you can't keep ducking. I think you can really make him very uncomfortable with that. Rachel, you heard what Jeff had to say about Frank's role in this. I mean, I think that if you we'll pull together some a much more full picture of the situation in Massachusetts, but the state government is bankrupt there. They passed this phony health care insurance plan, which is costing the state a lot of money and not providing much protection. There are foreclosures. In the last 25 years, the corridor, the industrial corridor outside of Boston, has pretty much been shut down. So I think there's quite a bit that we can make in this. But just give us your sense, because you had this opportunity, so to speak, to see him eye to eye. He really did just hysterically refuse to respond at all, not just to you, but to anybody there. This got people more angry, didn't it?
They're telling him to answer the question, saying that he was refusing to answer the question and to stop lying and things like that.
Well, I think to Jeff, to go back to you, this was one of the points that stood out to me at Lyndon LaRouche's webcast on Wednesday. And I'd like to take up the basic theme of that, but I think people should do that keeping in mind that Rachel's campaign, and there may be a couple of more that will run in selective districts, but that our job and the job that Rachel has taken on in doing this, and I have to say, Rachel, I commend you for your courage, because if anyone who saw that whole exchange between you and Barney Frank knows that you stood right up in front of him, and you told the truth in a very calm way. And that's what can make this campaign so exciting, that there's going to be someone in the race who's telling the truth. But this is exactly what we need. As Lyndon LaRouche was saying, we have a mass strike process. There are people all over the country who feel betrayed. And the question is going to be to educate and deepen that mass strike process. Now, Jeff, the thing that this mass strike process is going to have to take up is the question of the four power agreement. So I'd like to come back to that now and get your assessment on where things stand with the potential of the four power agreement, especially after the breakthroughs we've seen from Russia and China and the responses to the initiatives from Lyndon LaRouche last Wednesday.
Well, I think that there's really kind of two phases in the very recent period to this potentially really profound strategic breakthrough. First of all, you had the events themselves. Number one, in early mid-October, Lyndon and Helga LaRouche participated in the 7th International Conference on the Dialogue of Civilizations. It took place in Greece on Rhodes. And Mr. LaRouche gave one of the keynote presentations on the economics panel and laid out the idea that the reason that you need a four powers alliance between the United States, Russia, China, and India is because only through that combination of very large, very powerful nations can you break the control that is currently exerted over the global financial and economic system by what LaRouche refers to as the British Empire. And by that, he means a private financier oligarchy that happens to have its nominal headquarters in London, but which has assets and capabilities in the entire global private central banking system, most emphatically on Wall Street. And that the power of this system, which is otherwise referred to as globalization, is so great that you're not going to get the kind of radical change that LaRouche is saying is the only way to avoid a dark age without lining up the most powerful nations on the planet. So LaRouche's idea of focusing on the United States, Russia, China, and India is not based on the idea of excluding other countries. In fact, LaRouche knows that instantaneously you're going to get Japan, South Korea, a number of other countries enthusiastically joining in this combination. So LaRouche laid that idea out most recently at Rhodes. He had been discussing this for years, really decades. But then on the final day of the Rhodes conference, Mr. Yakunin, who is the head of the Russian National Rail Corporation and a very close ally of both President Medvedev and especially Prime Minister Putin, traveled to Vladivostok, met up with Prime Minister Putin there, and then went on to Beijing as part of the Russian delegation that was there to work through the actual programmatic details of an agreement in principle that was struck earlier in the year between the Russian and Chinese prime ministers, Medvedev and Hu Jintao, to work together on a high technology development project to access the vast strategic raw material wealth of the Russian far northeast. Now, this is not a British imperial looting project, but it's a project that will bring the most advanced scientific and engineering capabilities to bear on a very challenging proposition, namely building up infrastructure to get into a very remote permafrost area, sparsely populated. And so Russia and China are looking at cooperation on nuclear power, high-speed rail, and other kinds of advanced technologies associated with outfits like the Vernadsky Museum. So this was a tremendous breakthrough. It was a policy breakthrough and a conceptual breakthrough because Russia had been floundering around the idea that the wealth of the country was centered around the exporting of oil, gas, and strategic metals rather than a technological surge based on scientific innovation, education, and the like.
Now, Jeff, this has been a central feature of an ongoing dialogue for over the last, really going back to the early 1980s, between Lyndon LaRouche and a section of the scientific community and the economic community in Russia.
Absolutely. In fact, Mr. LaRouche was known among a lot of the top Russian scientists during the Andropov and Gorbachev period when LaRouche was basically public enemy number one of that particular Soviet faction, because LaRouche had gotten President Ronald Reagan to adopt his strategic defense initiative, his proposal for U.S.-Russian cooperation in carrying out a scientific and technological revolution around the deployment of new physical principles, defensive weapons, to eliminate the threat from nuclear weapons. And so Russian scientists in the early 1980s read slanders of LaRouche in the official Russian, then Soviet press. They saw LaRouche persecuted in the United States. And then following the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, when LaRouche got out of jail, he went to Russia and immediately entered into a direct, live, face-to-face dialogue with some of Russia's greatest scientists and economists. So you're right, this has got a long history to it. But I think the crucial thing is that, number one, a major policy change has occurred in both Russia and in China, which has now defined Russian-Chinese scientific and technological collaboration as the key to their survival. So the fundamental principle of LaRouche's four powers idea is now alive and prospering in this agreement between Russia and China. And there are indications of some important developments in India as well on the same track. So that was the first phase of these recent breakthrough developments, just really in the last 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah, you're listening to Jeffrey Steinberg from the Executive Intelligence Review. This is the LaRouche Show, and we're discussing the potential for a very significant shift strategically occurring at precisely the point that we've reached the end of an era, that we really have reached the end of the imperial era, and we'll be exploring that in a moment. But I also want to make sure that if you joined us late, we had an exciting announcement, some breaking news on the program. Rachel Brown, who became a national figure back in the summer when she courageously confronted the outrageous and almost cartoonish character Barney Frank at a town meeting. Rachel Brown has announced her candidacy for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Congress. Rachel is with us on the program, and she made that announcement earlier in the hour, and this is going to have repercussions that will shake not only the House Financial Services Committee and the broader support networks for Barney Frank in Washington, but probably also is going to cause some shaking in Wall Street and probably as well the center of the British Empire. So, Rachel, this is going to be quite an undertaking. And if there are some questions for Rachel, we can take them on the program. You can send your questions to radio@larouchepub.com. And probably within a week or so, we'll be able to tell you how you can contribute to that campaign, what you can do to help it. But keep your eye on LaRouchePAC.com. Now, Jeff Steinberg has just given us a picture of what this four-power agreement looks like. Jeff, Lynn talked about this a lot in this webcast last Wednesday, where he constantly came back to this question of what about the institutions in the United States, and how up to this point the institutions of the United States have failed. In fact, they've refused to challenge the obviously failed policies of the Bush and Obama administrations. What is the way that we're going to move the situation in the United States? Because as you say, Russia and China are moving. There's a potential for India. What about the United States?
Well, the most recent phase of this whole breakout process actually occurred around LaRouche's webcast on Wednesday, where almost instantaneously, not even after, but as the webcast was taking place, more and more people within the governing institutions of this country who've been more honest and willing to face up to the reality of this crisis, even if they've been unwilling to take courageous action, figured out that LaRouche was absolutely right, and that the recent developments with Russia and China represented a major victory, a major step on behalf of LaRouche's four-power strategy, and that basically the situation in Russia and China, the degree to which they've recognized the magnitude of the systemic collapse and have decided that they've got to change policies and to go in a direction that LaRouche has been promoting for years, if not decades, that fact in itself has shaken up some people within the governing circles in this country. The feedback that we're getting is that they are both stunned and see this now as an opportunity that no one can afford to miss. So I think the webcast itself conveyed with a degree of clarity and with a degree of moral authority that Mr. LaRouche asserted, that this has shaken things up. There's new potentialities for forces to move inside the United States on behalf of this four powers arrangement. Far more of a live fight is underway now since Wednesday than we had even just days before that.
Well, Jeff, I think one of the things that it would be important for us to do on the program today is to fill this out for people, not in terms of the specifics of the institutions, but in terms of what people can do. Because I know that a lot of the focus in the last couple of months has been on the healthcare policy, and there was a bit of confusion over what it means, the House vote in, by a very narrow margin under intense threats and blackmail that supported the so-called Obamacare bill. But that while this is going on, at the same time, the just breathtaking collapse of the U.S. economy has taken on a new dimension, exactly as LaRouche said it would in the month of October. Why don't we just review very briefly what's happening with the economy, because this is the backdrop, and along with it, the collapse of the dollar has had a kind of a slap, couple of cold slaps in the face to people who were trying to believe that there was a recovery.
Well, you know, right at the beginning of the webcast on Wednesday, Lyndon LaRouche went through his triple curve. This is a heuristic device that he developed in the mid-1990s and first presented publicly at a conference at the Vatican. And basically what LaRouche said is that you've got to look at the dynamic relationship between three phenomena that characterize an imperial monetarist system. You have monetary aggregates, the printing press operations of central banks and other means by which monetary instruments are generated. And right now, we are in the most severe global hyperinflationary blowout from the standpoint of monetary aggregates. Since the summer of 2007, when Lyndon LaRouche proposed his Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, and people like Barney Frank sabotaged it from being passed through the Congress. Since that time, by the official testimony of Neil Barofsky, who's the Inspector General of the TARP program, the bailout program, the Federal Reserve and Treasury have either laid out or authorized $23.7 trillion in funds to bail out this financial bubble, to bail out banks, insurance companies, General Motors, you name it, $23.7 trillion to try to fill a black hole that is absolutely bottomless. So that's hyperinflation on a scale not seen since November of 1923 in Weimar, Germany. So that's the first curve, and we are in an escalating hyperinflationary printing press blowout. The second curve is financial aggregates. And financial aggregates are stocks and bonds and things like that that under normal times have some relationship to trade and production. And we've seen peaks and collapses, and right now the financial aggregates, even with the building up of the stock market bubble again, are dwarfed by the massive increase in the rate of increase of the money supply, the monetary aggregates, the hyperinflationary money debt. And at the same time, you have a total collapse of physical production, particularly in the United States and Western Europe, but it's really a global phenomenon. So this is your triple curve, and this is a heuristic device for understanding how imperial systems, monetary, financial, oligarchical systems go into a death spiral, and that's what we're in right now.
And Jeff, there are people around the broader teams involved in policymaking who have been studying the triple curve.
Yes, that's exactly right. There's a group of economists who, in some cases, have even been either still are or up until recently part of advisory bodies to the Obama administration. But their approach has been to study LaRouche's triple curve and come to see that this is the only way to actually understand this phenomenon. Remember, during the Nixon period, they invented this crazy term called stagflation, which is monetary inflation and deflation of financial aggregates and costs of goods in society. But what that completely left out of the equation is that the driver is the collapse of physical production. We don't have the goods. We don't have the food production to sustain a world population of 6.7 billion people.
And that drop in production has gone on going back to even before the Nixon administration.
Right. It really began following the assassination of John Kennedy. It's accelerated dramatically. Look, there have been a net loss of 5 million jobs in the U.S. economy since Obama took office. And the White House is desperately trying to spin things to give the impression that the stimulus package has worked and that the crash threat is behind us. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, it's almost as though they're saying there are virtual jobs. Now, Jeff, this brings us back to the point that Rachel made earlier about the feeling of betrayal, because while there are people who do have a capacity to know this, and maybe they're being kept out of policymaking, but nevertheless, it's obvious to anybody who's looking at the real economy and looking what's happening to the population that we're seeing this kind of devastating collapse. And yet, the policy of the administration continues to be to stick to the bailout, to provide money for these bankrupt banks, to reject LaRouche's, the LaRouche plan, which is no more bailouts, bankruptcy reorganization, and credit for physical production, and instead to keep going for the bailout. So what Lyndon LaRouche discussed at the webcast Wednesday, and then I had a chance to talk with him afterwards, he emphasized that now the question is, will the people who are feeling betrayed go beyond telling the Congress to shut up and actually say to them, now we want you to do what's good for us. We're prepared to take over. Here's what the policy should be. This idea of educating the mass strike process. Can that affect these institutions? Can the institutions be moved if they see a popular upsurge around a program?
I think that there's no doubt that can happen, and that in fact it's the decisive factor. Look, you've got a lot of people in Washington, a lot of people in and around what Lyndon LaRouche refers to as the institution of the presidency, who know that the Obama administration is accelerating the disastrous direction that the country was taken during the previous Bush-Cheney administration. You know, there's no difference whatsoever between the Paulson bailout policy and what's been being done under Bernanke and Geithner and people like Larry Summers and Orszag, yeah, and Rahm Emanuel. It's the same exact policy, except we're moving now into an even more decisive phase of disintegration of the entire system. And they continue to insist that they're going to use hyperinflationary bailout methods and bullying tactics on Congress to ram this stuff through. We've reached the point already where we are on the last legs of our real physical economy. The population is furious. And, you know, you've got really at this point an 80% rejection of the policies of President Obama and his administration. And it just simply happens that the first line of hatred is directed at the Congress. And so this is a very volatile, very dangerous, very explosive situation. And the question is not whether or not the population is going to continue to revolt. The question is, are they going to be in the position to turn to the kind of leadership that will inform their revolt? Remember when Benjamin Franklin, coming out of one of the sessions of the Constitutional Convention, was approached on the street by a woman who said, Dr. Franklin, what is it that you are giving us? And his answer was, a republic, ma'am, if you can keep it. So we are at one of those existential moments where that's exactly the question that's on the table. Can we keep our republic? Can we go back to the principles of American system economics embedded in the Constitution itself? We are the only republic in the history of mankind that is based on a credit rather than an imperial monetary system. And if we go back to our constitutional principles, put the entire Federal Reserve System through a bankruptcy reorganization, reconstitute Glass-Steagall as a separation of commercial banking functions from speculative activity, and cancel the bailout. This was the big thing that Mr. LaRouche emphasized, along with the political power structure represented by the four powers. He said, the first step that must now be taken, since Congress blew it back in the summer and autumn of 2007 and failed to pass the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act. Right now, the first thing that's got to happen is that the bailout's got to be canceled and the money called back, and that's an integral part of going back to Glass-Steagall and putting these banks through bankruptcy reorganization, at least the commercial banking components, and let the rest of it just fall off the edge of the earth.
Now, Jeff, let me just make a point to our listeners, because this was solidified in a policy statement several weeks ago by Lyndon LaRouche. It's called the LaRouche Plan. And as one of my old friends, Fred Unifeld from Monroe, Louisiana, used to say, you got to put it in a nutshell. And I think Lynn put it in a nutshell with this LaRouche Plan, the no bailouts, take the money back, the Glass-Steagall standards, bankruptcy reorganization, and new credit, and all of that then connected to the idea of the United States joining with Russia, China, India to create a new financial system. Now, one of the things we need is we've got to print copies of this LaRouche Plan to circulate it. And those listening to this call, it's your responsibility to help us circulate it, which means once we print it, get it in your hands and distribute it. But we need some help to get it printed. And so one of the things you can do is you can contact us, you can call LaRouche PAC, you can go on the website and contribute through the website, but we need a mobilization. Now, Rachel, are you still with us?
Yep.
Yeah, because this is a big component of what you're going to be doing with your campaign. It's just what Jeff was describing of bringing this LaRouche Plan as the alternative to what we might call the bailout Barney Plan, which is more of the same. What kind of things do we do in a normal week in the Boston area to get these ideas out?
Well, we've been focusing a lot on looking for the leadership of the mass strike, and we've been hitting pretty much all of eastern Massachusetts, whereas we used to focus on the city of downtown Boston a lot. Now we've been spreading out to all the various rural towns and suburban towns surrounding Boston, and finding a pretty open response there of people that are really looking for a different solution. So that's what we do on a daily basis. We hit the streets around the local towns, the campuses, and we get these ideas out.
And this is something you're going to be doing now with the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, this question of the LaRouche plan and backing up this campaign, keep your eye open on LaRouche PAC. We'll have an announcement out probably within 24 hours that you can use and download and get it around. But Bailout Barney is going to be in trouble because there will be some new leadership. Now, Jeff, to come back to then this question of the four-power agreement, there was a statement, a very significant statement made by Russian President Medvedev in the last 48 hours, which indicates the consolidation of this perspective. What was it that Medvedev said, and why is this so important?
Well, it's actually a series of statements and articles that he's written in the last period since this policy shift occurred. Midweek, he delivered his annual State of the Nation address, and he had written an article several weeks earlier that kind of laid out and touched on all of the key conceptual points he presented in his State of the Nation address. And then a few days after that, in anticipation of the Asia-Pacific Economic Conference meeting that he's attending right now in Singapore today, in fact, with President Hu Jintao of China and President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton of the United States. Many other countries, 21 altogether, represented there. But what he basically said is that Russia had been operating under a false idea of how to rebuild their economy. He said, we focused on exporting oil and gas and precious metals and did not place emphasis on technological and scientific progress. And I think, you know, most telling, he really focused on this idea of building a 21st century economy based on innovation. In other words, the factor of human creativity as the driver for human society and for all economic progress. It's human creativity that's the issue. And so what he's saying is that Russia has to become a society of scientific and technological innovators, and that the focus has to be on advances in these areas, nuclear power, high-speed rail, the most advanced scientific work, which in the case of Russia centers out of the Mendeleev Museum, work that is vital to the success of this development project in the far northeast corner of Asia. And the Chinese have very advanced work that they've done on maglev and high-speed rail. The Russians have certain advanced work that they've done on the nuclear power production. You probably, some of you may remember that in 2007, in the spring, Lyndon LaRouche delivered a presentation that was read for him at a conference in Moscow on the importance of the high-speed rail tunnel under the Bering Straits, which would, for the first time in history, link up by overland high-speed rail all of Eurasia, all of Africa, and all of the entire Western Hemisphere. This is an integral part of this Pacific Northeast Development Project, which is what Russia and China have agreed to as a kind of a demonstration project of a fundamental shift in orientation of both countries. Russia was focused on gas and oil and precious metal exports. China was focused on cheap labor production, actually below break-even costs on a world market level, to export massive amounts of goods to the United States and Europe. They turn their resources away from the urgent buildup of the interior of their country and created the situation where you had a certain emerging upper class, middle class, billionaires club in areas along the coastal area, but not much progress in alleviating poverty among 600 to 800 million Chinese living in the interior.
So, Jeff, we could say then with real definitive statement that all the preconditions now are in place in terms of the ideas exist, the spread of these ideas among key institutions has occurred, there's discussion, there's motion, there's we're at the point of the earth being moved around some of these. And so this is really on the plate now of the president. This is something that Obama could do were he to be induced to break with the Geithner-Summers City of London destruction of the U.S. economy.
That's right. If we win it in the United States, we win it globally. If we don't win it in the United States, then sadly, Russia and China, left simply to their own devices, even with India's participation, are not going to succeed in literally defeating the global power of the British Empire. That's the key issue. Now, the question of how we win the fight in the United States, I think, is very much at the heart of this question of the mass strike process. Clearly, the lower 80% population, that's in terms of income bracket, here in the United States, are in big trouble. They're suffering. They see a worse situation looming ahead. They worry about the future of their children, their grandchildren, and they are furious. Now, at the same time, there are elements within the governing institutions of this country that tend to be weak-kneed and compromising, but who also increasingly are coming to see, for example, that LaRouche was absolutely right on April 11th when he said that President Obama is a narcissist, he's a total disaster, and he warned the institutions, you guys have to bring this guy under control. Now, there's been at least two recent instances that I can think of, one in the case of Lyndon Johnson and one in the case of Richard Nixon, where people from the establishment, quote unquote, from within the institution of the presidency, went to the president and told him it was time to leave. In the case of Lyndon Johnson, people like Clark Clifford, Paul Warnke, and others went to Lyndon Johnson and told him that he had lost sight of the fact that he had lost the support of the American people because of Vietnam, because we got involved in the very land war in Southeast Asia that Douglas MacArthur and Dwight Eisenhower warned John Kennedy against. And so Lyndon Johnson was persuaded that his time was up, and he resigned from re-election. He served out his presidency but did not run for re-election. He canceled his campaign even though he was a shoo-in to win the Democratic nomination for re-election. 4 years later, in the context of Watergate, I guess maybe 5 or 6 years later, Senator Howard Baker and others went to Richard Nixon at the point that Nixon, already facing impeachment trial in the Senate, was deluding himself that he was on top of the world and he'd weather the storm. He was delivered the message, you've got 48 hours to pack your bags and leave. Now, so there's precedence. There's precedence in recent decades. And the question is, are you going to get a combination of patriots within the institution of the presidency who are going to muster up the courage to walk into the Oval Office and tell the president that he's got to either put himself under the control of the institution and stop his ego trips and stop his destructive policies made in London, and under those circumstances, he can stay on the job. New management takes over as teleprompter. He still gets the presidential signing pen. And in fact, if LaRouche's policies prevail, he'll be remembered as a president who did more to turn around economic and political disaster than any president since Franklin Roosevelt. Not a bad legacy.
You know, and I think this is that people should go back to listen to Lyndon LaRouche's Wednesday webcast. If you didn't hear it, it's up on LaRouchePack.com, and in it, Lynn lays out the broad strategic picture that we've just been discussing. But also, he continually comes back to this question of what is it that is a source of wealth? What is it that an economy must do, that a society must take as its sacred mission, which is this idea of developing the creative powers of labor? And the everything Jeff just discussed in terms of the institutional potential, it's not going to be realized without an accelerated mobilization of the population, but around specific program, around these ideas. And it's the responsibility of the American people right now to not just complain. And I know a lot of our listeners are out there, you know, they take up the negative side of the story. Oh, Obama's no good. The administration's no good. Barney Frank's a bum. But then they don't do anything. And now you have an example of a young woman who, in fact, was called by Stephen Colbert town hall hero, Rachel Brown. You know, so we have an individual, a young woman, who's demonstrating the leadership to go out and talk to people and organize them. So, Rachel, I want to give you, we just have a couple minutes left, I want to give you a chance to, if you want to say something more to the listeners to get them off their rear ends and into the campaign, here's your chance.
Yeah, I guess just that it is going to be crucial to get people, as has been emphasized, to actually do something, that it's not just enough to be a naysayer and sit on the couch and say you don't like what's going on, but that we are at a crucial turning point in history right now, and that we do have an opportunity to smash the political career of people like Barney Frank. And he has represented the complete betrayal of the population by Congress over the last several decades. And these guys are sworn by oath to defend the general welfare, and they're not only not doing that, they're actually lying to the population about what they are doing and what their policies are. I think LaRouche made a good point in his webcast where he said, you know, people are told that a bill will be about a particular issue, and you know, they're portrayed in the media that they'll be defended by this bill, but in actuality, the bill does not actually do that. And these congressmen know that. So, yeah, it's time that the people stop putting up with this and actually do something to stop it.
Okay, and I think that you just heard a clear picture from Rachel. She's committed to do it. And by the way, before she took on Barney Frank, she was a big nemesis of Nancy Pelosi because Rachel can do a very excellent imitation of Nancy Pelosi. Although I must say, Rachel, you can't quite make your face as unliving and unreal as Nancy Pelosi looks in person. Jeff, we have just under about a minute and a half. You want to just summarize this picture?
Well, we need the mobilization of the population because it's the guarantor. It's the factor that is going to drive certain people who will otherwise tend to fall short of what's required of this crisis situation. Even people who legitimately claim the mantle of being patriots within these various institutions, they will not do what has to be done. I can assure you of that, unless they see the pitchforks coming at them from behind. And the population has to not only continue to demonstrate a level of political awareness and a level of anger, but you've got to follow the precepts of Percy Shelley, who in his historic essay, In Defense of Poetry, pointed out that in these periods of crisis, because human beings are inherently creative, they have the ability to grasp and master profound and passionate ideas about the nature of man and nature. And so it's the responsibility of everyone who fancies themselves as a patriot of this country to understand LaRouche's plan. Now, I just wanted to say one final thing in closing, which is that Helga Zepp LaRouche and Natalia Vitrenko, a leading political figure in the Ukraine, have issued a call for endorsements of the LaRouche plan, including the bankruptcy reorganization and the formation of this Four Powers Alliance to defeat the British Empire. And we have a draft resolution along the same lines circulating among local and state elected officials, the same people who were behind the HBPA mobilization, who now we're calling on to come out and publicly endorse the LaRouche plan as the only solution to this crisis to avert a dark age.
And Jeff, we're out of time, but those are up on the LaRouche PAC website. We want to get signatures on both of those. And the LaRouche Natalia Vitrenko statement is very significant. This is something you can do to move the institutions. It may be possible that we have Helga on the LaRouche show next week. So, Jeff, thank you. Rachel, good luck, and I expect you to come on regularly to update us on the progress in running bailout Barney out of politics. So thank you for joining us today. This has been the LaRouche Show. We'll be with you next Saturday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Goodbye.